So hello, everybody. Thank you, Tim, for having me. The thing I need to do is to figure out how to advance the slides. Is it just down arrow?
Down arrow, yep.
Good deal. Well, so my particular contribution to this this gathering today is that I'm wanting to talk about the management of sort of extensive plant invasions, landscape scale plant invasions, in the context of the sort of agricultural landscapes that I think we have good reason to sort of anticipate as we look ahead. And so I'm an agronomist by trade, so that's my focus. And the premise that I want to suggest is that in the next 10 or 20 years, we are going to see extensive emergence of what we might, well, what many people call novel ecosystems. So these are situations where across landscapes we have sort of complex patterns in both space and time, a functional biodiversity that is producing, that serves to be multifunctional, meaning that it's capable of producing both conventional agricultural commodities and also ecological services in good measure. And so this will be, I think, you know, a real sort of reconception of how we think about landscape, at least in North America. So issues of sort of historical condition, what was the vegetation like pre-settlement, et cetera, I think are going to become less important. And I guess what I would suggest to you all is that as we ask how in the world we are going to manage to essentially double food production while managing to hang in there in the face of climate change and also not destroy the integrity of the biosphere in the process, I want to suggest that these kind of perennialized agricultural landscapes are going to be very important in stepping up to that challenge. So, if you'll grant me all those premises for at least the next 20 minutes, I want to sort of suggest that a major threat to the integrity of these systems will be what some folks call, I think very evocatively, green cancer. In other words, so-called environmental weeds that are able to really dominate landscapes. And, of course, you know, there are, I think, probably 40 or 50 species of plants that qualify as green cancers. But just to briefly talk about one so you know what I'm kind of talking about, Mimosa pigra is an important invasive in a lot of situations in Asia. Tim, is there a pointer?
I use the mouse and we'll be able to see it on the screen.
I see. As long as you don't. Oh, excellent. Well, I was worried about time anyway. So Mimosa pigra is, you know, one of these systems that, you know, just gums up the works of livelihood systems, essentially, you know, in multiple ways. It disrupts livelihoods. And so, you know, I think this kind of statement pretty much sums up the way that, you know, particularly in the kind of landscapes that I'm talking about where, you know, a wide variety of managed plant ecosystems are being used for a wide variety of goods and services, commodities, and other things, the presence of these invasives that are capable of really dominating landscapes is a very serious problem. So, what is it that the science of invasion ecology is kind of doing in response to these green cancers? And I want to comment on several different developments that I think are important steps in the right direction and then suggest a third step that I think is particularly essential, and that'll be sort of my theme for you today. So to begin with, ecological research into managed ecosystems is now definitely in a phase of kind of upscaling, I think it's fair to say. So this implies a shift away from the previous very strong focus on, you know, sort of short-term studies that focus on technologies of removal and control of IAS, which, by the way, stands for invasive alien species. And so this means more analysis of spatial patterns of these creatures across the landscape and their dynamics. This means a real upswing in modeling of invasion, both invasions in terms of just the sort of dynamics across space, but also especially the processes that drive that, and also the development of ecosystem conceptual models as an important tool. And so the findings of this this kind of this trend, I would say, is, you know, a substantial deepening of our sort of systemic understanding of plant invasion. You know, why does this happen? If we get beyond the sort of, you know, putting out the fires of how do we control invasions in some, you know, cost-effective way, we need to get beyond that thinking, and, of course, and ask fundamental questions about why we have invasions. And so I think this whole trend of research has been useful. Just to quickly give you an example of what I'm talking about, this is from a recent paper by this group in Quebec, Jodoin and company. And what they were able to show is that, so common reed has had, Phragmites australis has had this major, you know, upswing in its abundance in the province of Quebec in the last few decades. And they were able to demonstrate that, in fact, highway road margins are just a very important place in the landscape where this invasion is being kind of driven. And they were able to show that, as well, that, you know, there were certain, it wasn't just any roadsides, but it was, in fact, roadsides that were bordered by corn and soybean fields that were, you know, particularly important to the invasion. So they were able to show, essentially, that there is a, on a landscape scale, there's a kind of invasion window being opened for the species along roadsides, and especially roadsides by a certain kind of land use. As for ecosystem conceptual models, what I'm talking about is this kind of formalism in which you try to identify drivers, which are sort of top-down factors that are important to invasion, and stressors, which are particular sources of stress in an ecosystem, and then the ecological effects that flow from those, and then the effects of these on attributes that people care about in ecosystems. And they're, you know, I think a very useful tool in organizing sort of big picture thinking about managed ecosystems and the things that people are concerned about, particularly when there are multiple dimensions that are really important. So the use of ecosystem conceptual models has been on the upswing as well. This is one from a national park situation in Australia, and you can see that the thinking about weeds very much connects the presence of weeds to other factors, you know, road building and construction being a source of weeds, weed seeds, as are recreational pressures, as are feral wildlife. So you can see there's, you know, a broad sort of view is being taken here of why do we have these invasion problems here, and how do weed management fit in relationship to other things that are going on that are of importance. So that's a step forward. However, I think there's an additional degree of sort of upshift that is really important to think about. So this kind of upscaled version of invasion ecology is addressing, it's fair to say, biophysical patterns and processes, but tending to miss a very important issue, which is the why at a kind of deeper level. And it's one thing to say, well, recreational activities in some way are important to plant invasion, but what I think it's fair to say is that we need a much more nuanced, much less sort of aggregated, much more spatially explicit sort of examination of that. And because otherwise we will miss a really key level of causation, and that is the sort of nitty-gritty detail of what is the interplay of biophysical factors with socioeconomic and cultural factors to drive invasions. And so the grass fire cycle is, you know, a real good example of the way that plant invasion is, you know, kind of an emergent property of an interaction between the biophysical and the social, essentially. So the grass fire feedback cycle, if you're not familiar with it, is driven by quite a few fire-promoting invasive plants, kind of qualify as creators of this cycle. And, you know, essentially, the human activity of land clearing and the introduction of certain flammable grasses, you know, act together to change landscapes, and these grassland ecosystems evolve that have certain characteristics that tend to promote fire, and you find then this sort of positive feedback loop between fire that, you know, certainly affects Bromus tectorum dynamics and certainly affects Chromalina, two weeds we've heard about already today. And so that's an example of a, you know, a sort of eco-social system, or the term that's becoming predominant is the coupled human and natural system view of the world, where we're really aware that Okay, human activities as sort of embodied by what you could call social system, and the biophysical patterns and processes of an agroecosystem are very closely interlinked in a, you know, more or less tight kind of feedback relationship. And so there is a discipline called, which is sort of starting to be called land change science, that is really all about this interplay, these coupled human and natural systems, this interplay between the biophysical and the social. And land change science, if you're not familiar too much with that term, refers to the sort of integration of biophysical, social, and spatial sciences that has occurred, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years. And just to give you a quick illustration of what I'm talking about, let me give you a story about bracken invasion in the southern Yucatan Peninsula region, which is, this is the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, and this is the region that we're talking about here. So there's been a major upswing in the abundance of bracken fern in this area in recent years, and something like a fourfold increase in invaded area in the last two decades or so. And so, you know, and here I'm drawing the work of this woman, Laura Schneider, who's at Rutgers. Her interpretation of this invasion is that it's really all about the interplay of the details, again, the kind of nitty-gritty detail of land use strategies, of certain land degradation processes, and of fire regimes, all of which are kind of closely interlinked. And bracken itself, if you're not too familiar with that plant, is an invasive plant species all over the world. It's a real tough invader. It's both tends to increase fire frequency and to be highly tolerant of fire. It's very stress tolerant. It doesn't get grazed very much. It propagates readily. So it has some kind of key biophysical attributes, that interact very much with some of the socioeconomic factors and dynamics in history of this region. So, for example, this area of Mexico has had a number of federal government sort of programs have been deployed to try to shift land use and have caused things like the clearing of large areas of forest for, both crop and grazing agriculture that have worked for a while and then been abandoned, leading to big areas that just provided massive invasion windows for the bracken to come in through. There have the amount of labor availability has fluctuated quite a bit. Economic alternatives to agriculture have been increasing in this region. It's less agriculturally dependent. And then there's been this advent of this kind of growing chilies for markets. That's a new form of agriculture. And Laura Schneider's interpretation of all this is that where we find the bracken coming in through the window and really being introduced into the landscape is on these older sort of cooperative living arrangements called ejidos. And in the ejidos, where there is more land available per person and more non-agricultural activity and less cultivation of chiles, we find very large annual increases of bracken. So this is where this species is coming into the landscape. And in particular, it's areas where folks are no longer motivated to do the work to keep the bracken out because they have, you know, more profitable things to do with their time that is, you know, allowing bracken to come into the landscape. So other more recently established places that are much more dependent on chili production have much lower rates of increase of bracken. So the findings then from this kind of land change science view of plant invasion are, you know, just to sort of underscore something that I think intuitively we understand very well, and that is that economic and social determinants of land use and land cover as well are strong determinants of invasion, and that land managers often have very significant ability to control invasions if it's worth it to them. But another really important thing that I think we find out from this whole perspective is that a lot of times there is major heterogeneity in the way that folks across the landscape think about invasive alien species. This was mentioned this morning around, grass that's increasing, you know, the guinea grass in Hawaii that, you know, it's an excellent forage crop species, and it's also a very serious plant invader. That kind of heterogeneity in how invasive alien species are viewed is commonplace. And in the world of environmental management, whenever you have major conflicts of interest about how the environment is to be managed, you tend to have something that, that folks are starting to call wicked problems in environmental management. And what I mean by a wicked problem is illustrated by the sort of, if we have problem space, if you will, this graph here where we have problems where arranged in terms of the uncertainty of the situation and the level of value conflict. What folks are starting to call wicked problems are things that are up in that high quadrant of that graph there. And these are situations where, you know, there's major disagreement about what should be done. There's major disagreement about whether a given alien species is even a problem. And so this calls, in the view of many of us, for a really major reconception of how science functions. So in situations where values conflict is low and uncertainty is low, I submit to you, we know what to do as scientists. And, you know, kind of so-called normal science is where, you know, we follow well-established routines. That's the way to go. In this domain of wicked problems where we have high uncertainty and high conflict, I suggest to you quite a different kind of science is called for. Some people, there's quite a few different terms for this. Some people call this second-order R&D, distinguishing it from a first-order R&D that's that kind of more normal science situation I was talking about. Other people are developing these ideas under the banner of sustainability science, but it really is quite a different way of thinking about science. And the objective of sustainability science, I think, in my view, is that, first of all, explicitly, the goal is to make progress on these wicked problems. Secondly, the idea is to create new understanding, not through the work of science by itself, but by science that is strongly engaged in a larger sort of learning system that is based on a social network that calls on quite a few different of the many different ways to be rational. Being scientific is obviously not the only way to be rational. And this is a science that has, I think, a very distinctive aim, and that is to both join in rather than standing aside from, and to support collective learning, innovation, and action by multi-stakeholder groups. And in particular, to try to develop what many folks are calling new management regimes. So the basic idea is what we really need to do is to be shifting the basic management regimes that we have as we deal with invaded landscapes. So the idea here is that our current management regimes, our current, you know, ways by which land use is kind of determined and managed, and the invasions that follow from that, are very well established and very resilient because they're rooted in professional roles and they're rooted in worldviews and mental models that are really well established and that people are used to doing. And that the sort of premise of the second order R&D is that we must shift these mental models and worldviews to change the way the land is managed. And only by doing that will we actually start to get a grip on these green cancers. That's the basic idea. And I certainly don't have time to review the sort of track record of this idea, but I think it's fair to say that this whole concept of science is getting some traction. And just, I think this is a useful graph to sort of suggest what it is that this, quote, second-order R&D is really aiming for. And the idea is to shift a number of dimensions, some of which are biophysical and some of which are social, about situations. CHANS, remember again, is a coupled human and natural system. So any managed ecosystem / landscape. And the idea is that, well, we have stakeholding, which are the sort of combined worldviews, sense of what are the key values, what is sense of, you know, it's really important and what we have to defend in this landscape. We have the roles of institutions. Well, we have institutions and policies, another largely social factor. We have the biophysical, and we have also the key factor of facilitation. Is there anyone who's willing to help folks think about these things integratively? And the basic idea of second order science is that we are trying to move things along this 45 degree line here where we are both changing the basic understanding of a managed landscape and why there's invasion, and we are also most certainly trying to actually change practices, especially at the level of institutions and policies. So this is what this kind of science aims to do. A very important question is, by what vehicle could this happen? And just to draw your attention to this picture from the landscape ecologists Nassauer and Opdam. They are also landscape designers. Their idea is that the design of landscapes is a very key sort of point by which the effort in broader societies to kind of decide what sort of landscape it wants and to implement and monitor and assess and to revise its policies, which obviously is the concept of adaptive management. Their idea is that there's a social process of landscape change, there's a scientific process by which, you know, a variety of scientific disciplines contribute to that, and their idea is that the design provides a sort of unifying activity that could bring both broader, you know, a wide range of social actors who care about a managed landscape and scientists together to figure out how to make things better. That's the sort of, you know, vehicle. And there's, you know, there's, I could cite you a number of case studies that shows that this approach does get some traction. But what I want to move on to is, to make this all a bit less abstract and theoretical, I want to share with you a sort of ongoing case study from our work in Minnesota. But I need, Tim, we started a little late. What's your sense of how much time I have?
You have 9 minutes left.
Okay. For my whole half hour?
Yes, your whole half hour.
Okay. And that includes whatever allowance I got for starting late? Okay. Okay. Cool. So I'll be quick with this. Bioenergy is obviously, from agriculture, is a very interesting question. I think it's the most interesting sort of manifestation of this premise that I suggested to you guys, that future agricultural landscapes are going to be based more on perennial agriculture, more on plant diversity, and more on complex patterns across landscapes that accomplish work, that provide ecological services. So bioenergy development is underway, but bioenergy can energy development cannot sort of ignore a wide range of environmental problems that managed landscapes have, wildlife, water quality, etc. The thing that I think is very interesting to us in Minnesota is that bioenergy development provides a number of opportunities for managing invasive alien species. And so for us, we are starting to think about a kind of relatively new concept, the idea of a multifunctional fuel shed. This is simply an area where biomass feedstocks for renewable energy are produced. Perennial annual crops are placed in some sort of spatial and temporal pattern across a landscape that both provides commodities, biomass, and others, and then generates a variety of ecological goods and services. The key idea is to put the biomass crops in areas that are considered to be marginal in terms of annual crop production, but are good for perennial agriculture. If you do careful GIS analyses of Midwest agricultural landscapes, you find there are actually lots of areas where it would make a whole lot of sense to do this. This is an area in southern Minnesota where we did a careful GIS study of places where farmers probably weren't making that much money growing corn and beans, and it would make a lot of sense to grow perennial crops instead. And you can see it's a fairly large fraction of the environment, and you can imagine that if those were a variety of woody and herbaceous perennial biomass crops in all those pink areas, that would be a very different landscape in terms of its ecological functioning. And I submit to you there would be the plant invasion situation would be very different. So we are looking at a kind of a case study there's been a new power plant constructed right at the edge of the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area. Creates a market demand for about 10,000 acres of perennial biomass crops, which is a very unique and useful thing. Problem is nobody grows hardly any biomass crops right now. So the question is, how can we get these biomass crops on the landscape? And how will that create new opportunities to manage invasive alien species in this fuel shed, of which we have lots, suffice it to say. And The basic idea that we're pursuing is we are trying to develop a second order R&D project that takes advantage of the fact that a fuel shed that has a diversity of perennial biomass crops will produce lots of benefits, not just biomass, but water quality, wildlife, flood protection, carbon storage, etc. There's lots of folks that think that's a good idea and think they can get some bang for their buck out of encouraging that kind of land use change. And so our work is to form farmers and a wide variety of other stakeholders into essentially a regional coalition that will help us change worldviews, practices, understanding sufficiently to actually get these perennial crops out on that landscape. And we've got, you know, a pretty large research budget and quite a gang of graduate students working on a wide variety of the many chicken and egg problems that we've got. Thanks, Tim. But the key point is that this is our effort to create a sort of arena where a wide variety of stakeholders, so the Nature Conservancy is a key partner, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is a key partner, willing customers for some of the ecological services that can be provided by this landscape. So we are trying to work very systematically to provide an arena where we can actually do this kind of second order research and development and potentially profoundly change the landscape of this area, and by virtue of the fact that this new bioenergy facility can burn, would be very happy to burn all manner of invasive species, we have, you know, excellent opportunities to get, you know, new control of the all these plant invasions we have in this landscape. So I think that's a good stopping point, and I would welcome any questions or comments. Yeah.
What are the critiques of these fuel sheds, or are they? I mean, that seems like just wonderful use of the landscape, and I mean that. I know nothing about them. So the people that are on the other side that you have to bring in, what are their critiques?
Well, I would say that, first of all, we have a very well entrenched corn ethanol industry in the Midwest that thinks that that's the place that society should invest its research and development dollars, which are limited. So, you know, that's less a critique than a competitor in some sense. You know, the fact that corn and soybean farmers, you know, think that a lot of folks think that it's just not farming to grow grass and to grow trees. So, another great one is that we have well-informed conservation biologists in the Department of Natural Resources who think that trees are a major problem if you're trying to conserve grassland biodiversity, like birds, for example. So if we want to grow agroforestry systems in this landscape that are anywhere near grasslands, the DNR has a problem with that. They just want us to grow grass. So what I'm saying is that I don't think there's anybody who thinks the general idea is a bad idea, but certainly whether it's worth investing in compared to other alternatives is very debated. And there are competing interests, say, between the plant that burns the biomass, who wants lots of different feedstock types, you know, harvestable over the course of the whole year, because it makes their supply chain economics work out. And then over here we have conservationists who, you know, have a narrow conception of what a managed grassland should look like. It's got to have 23 species, and there better not be any trees around. You know, so it's those kinds of, it's that heterogeneity in interest that we are fighting our way through. And if we don't have a forum that lets those groups try to work it out, we're not going to get anywhere. So that's the key to it all. That's the idea, yeah.
Some of the things that you're considering in addition to, you know, production of a bio crop.
Right. So the Minnesota DNR has this great new program called the Working Land Initiative, and they're trying to manage 10 square mile units in farm country as whole landscapes. and aiming to get a certain percentage of grassland and wetland. And so their idea is that rather than paying farmers to take land out of conservation, we will try to add whatever we need to do to sweeten the deal to get, say, farmers to grow grasslands. You know, and there's this new program called Harvestable Habitat. And, you know, you may or may not know that most of the federal grassland programs really restrict your ability to harvest anything from that grassland. So the idea that we would grow something for conservation value, but we could also farm it as well, that's a new idea. And, you know, encountering some resistance. But yes, the general idea is multifunctionality, production of both commodities and ecological services from targeted introduction of perennials into the landscape. Yes?
Just play devil's advocate. I truly don't know
anything. No, great.
This sounds to me like what we did with our national forest. They were multiple use, and the environmentalists called them multiple of use.
Right.
So is it, what you call them, something harvest? I
mean, harvestable habitat.
Harvestable habitat. It sounds wonderful, but it almost sounds like an oxymoron. I'm still not getting a picture of what... It sounds like these lands could have been refugia for native grassland species or wildlife.
Right.
And they're long-lived perennials, and you're going to harvest them.
Right. Excellent point. Yes, will this be a land of many abuses? I think that's the phrase. But so here's the deal. The current harvestable habitat program lets you harvest every other year. And the point is, you got to do something with these grasslands. You know, what folks have done in the past is to burn them, and it doesn't work to burn them because they don't have enough folks to burn them. So the idea is to shift the incentive to manage to the farmer. And if that can be done successfully, and if you can actually, you know, have enough restrictions in harvesting to get your grassland bird reproduction and get your biomass yield, then the whole thing could work out pretty good, you know, because you have changed the practices and attitudes of the farmers. So now, instead of establishing, say, a conservation reserve program land, which is notoriously an invasion window, instead of establishing that and then the farmer just ignores it, you have some incentive to harvest it, to manage it, to keep the invasives out. You know, and you've accomplished a real qualitative shift in the whole management regime. But you're quite right, the devil's in the details.
I think we'll need to leave it there. Let's thank Nick one more time.
Thanks a lot, you guys.